Hi, Bitch listeners. Welcome back to another episode of Bitch Radio. I'm Sherston Johnson, the web content manager at Bitch Media. Today, we're sharing a piece from the archives, an episode of Read My Bitch featuring Brittany Shute reading The Ambition Condition, which first went up in June of 2010. Enjoy, and for more information on how you can read your bitch, visit bitchmedia.org/audio. Welcome to another episode of Read My Bitch, the podcast where Bitch Magazine readers read aloud one of their favorite articles from the archives and then discuss it. Today you'll hear from Brittany Shute, who's not just a Bitch Magazine reader, but a Bitch Magazine and blog contributor as well. Brittany will be reading a selection from Anna Clark's article, The Ambition Condition, which was published in issue number 41 from the fall of 2008. A newcomer to the freelance world, Brittany has plenty to say about the gendered nature of the industry. But before we get to that, here's Brittany reading The Ambition Condition.
Anyone who has stepped into a literary community, readings, performances, writing workshops, MFA programs, will testify to the disclaimers that issue regularly from the mouths of women writers in particular. This is just something I thought I'd try, and I'm not really a poet, but are words regularly uttered even by those who made drastic life changes in order to carve out time to write? I prepared for months for a major fiction contest in college, for instance, which I entered 5 years in a row, claiming to others each time that I just threw something together. Later, I applied to a single MFA fiction program and told no one until I got in. I just didn't want anyone to know what I wanted most. Perhaps I was preparing for failure. If I said openly that I not only wanted to be a writer, but that I worked hard at it, my ambitions could be judged against external rewards and easily dismissed when I missed out on them. There's no simple gender indicator for the weird fusion of insecurity and ambition, of the feigned nonchalance and quiet competitiveness that's common in writers of all sorts. But these traits are complicated by the cultural caricatures of ambitious women and the uneven historical patterns that have dictated whose talent is rewarded and whose isn't. Whether they write novels or cover stories or op-eds, even the most talented women writers often aren't validated in the same ways that their male counterparts are. While there are a few Neanderthals who would publicly say that the byline gap in literary journals and periodicals is due to the fact that women can't write as well as men, the usual justifications include shrugging dismissals, like, quote, "we don't get enough quality submissions by women." When I pointed out the 5-29 byline ratio in the fall 2006 issue of the Virginia Quarterly Review on my website, for instance, the journal's editor, Ted Genoways, commented on the post that, quote, "unfortunately, the disparity in our issues is, I think, more reflective of a symptom than a root cause. There simply seem to be fewer women who are freelance journalists, travel writers, and political pundits, three areas that now largely compose our editorial content. As a result, the good ones are in high demand and often out of our price range." The byline gap closes in the bookstore. Women publish fiction, poetry, and nonfiction at a rate that's representative of their actual numbers. But this is no meritocratic utopia. Women's writing is often met with dismissive assumptions. This is why female authors often disguise themselves with pen names and ambiguous initials. From George Sand to George Eliot, Isaac Dennison to E. Nesbitt, P.D. James to James Triptee Jr., there's a long history of women writers who have used disguised names to realize their ambitions. Even J.K. Rowling, the best-selling author of all time, adopted a neutral moniker on her way to success. Before Harry Potter became a phenomenon, Bloomsbury, Rowling's publisher, asked her to use her initials to reassure the target audience of young boys who might be reluctant to pick up a book by Joanna Rowling, a female author. Ambition is a slippery creature in the lives of writers of all genders. No one is safe from feeling uneasy about affirming one's literary ambitions, and insecurity is the devil of anyone who faces a blank page. But the thing is, women are more likely to be justified in doubting themselves. Yes, a woman is less likely to win the Nobel Prize in Literature. In 106 years of the prize, only 11 winners, about 10% of that total, have been female. In the Pulitzer Prize for fiction's 60-year history, female authors have snagged the award 27 times. Shaking out 57 years of the National Book Award for Fiction reveals a mere 15 winners. As for journalists, the gender gap indicates that women are far less likely to land their stories in the nation's top magazines and newspapers. Likewise, in the digital world, political candidates made a point of stopping by the yearly cost convention last summer, headlined by a prominent progressive male blogger, but were absent from the BlogHer conference, which drew top women bloggers together. And so on. Furthermore, to even say that you want to write lasting novels, garner hundreds of thousands of blog hits, or hand make a chapbook is to expose yourself to the "who do you think you are to have anything to say" sort of pummeling that Emily Gould received in the wake of her New York Times Magazine cover story. It can be tempting, then, for women in particular, to write quietly and hope that their work will speak for itself. But by not owning up to her ambitions, whether they are in public or private realms, a writer feeds the machine that discounts the aspirations and talents of all women writers. The silence is implicit support for editors who claim that their byline disparity is because women don't want it enough. It sets an example for other writers that ambition is something to be ashamed of. Though it might be the last thing in the world she means to do, by keeping her intentions for her work hidden, a female writer allows others to make assumptions about her work and to decide where it will and will not go. Obviously, there are plenty of women writers who aren't shy about declaring what they want for their writing. Jacqueline Wright, a Los Angeles playwright, told me, quote, "Perhaps because I just turned 40, the need to look like I don't work that hard on my writing seems absurd. I do work hard at creating my plays, as well as finding homes for them and some money for me." There are certainly other variables that might explain away tentativeness in a woman writer, like perfectionism, unfamiliarity with the medium, or worry that she will be seen as careerist. Or, in the case of nonfiction writers, elevating her opinions above others. Deborah Siegel leads workshops for writers who want to translate their academic research into accessible books for the larger public. Rather than expressing uneasiness about ambition, Siegel says that women scholars in particular need to hear that, quote, "going public with their ideas and making their writing more pop doesn't mean selling out." Siegel adds that the individual struggles of women writers have public reverberations. If women scholars and advocates who aspire to a public voice shy away or sit back and wait to be discovered, she said, we will continue to live in this echo chamber where the same three male pundits make the rounds on the Sunday morning talk shows and the same 10 guys keep publishing op-eds. The narrative our culture creates about the writers it treasures and those whom it barely respects shapes who is and isn't admitted into the literary canon, to say nothing of who publishing houses deem marketable. Take a recent interview with novelist and essayist Gore Vidal in the UK's Independent that called Vidal, quote, the last surviving giant of American literature's golden age. Aside from implicitly brushing aside the still-flourishing likes of Joyce Carol Oates and Toni Morrison, the article only reifies how a writer's persona may be more crucial than his or her work. The headline summarizes it neatly. Quote, Gore Vidal, literary feuds, his, quote, vicious mother, and rumors of a secret love child. He slept with Kerouac, hung out with Jackie O, and feuded with Mailer. Whatever the value of Vidal's writing, it is, for the moment, beside the point. The detail of his biography contribute to the value the culture puts on his work. Oates and Morrison are respected, awarded, and published at a rate that is comparable to Vidal's, of course. But without his persona, will they ever be as embedded in the narrative of literary and cultural history? There's nothing inherently wrong with Vidal's colorful biography being entangled with his literary worth. What's problematic is that the individuals who are validated in this way are so frequently ones that fit into a hyper-masculine literary lion caricature. Ernest Hemingway, F. Scott Fitzgerald, Norman Mailer, Kurt Vonnegut, Harold Bloom, Langston Hughes, Jack Kerouac, Richard Wright, Hunter S. Thompson, John Gardner. Their contemporary digital counterparts might include Matt Drudge and Marcos Moulitsas. Historically, there's been little room for women in that public story. And for whatever their writing is worth, and some of it is fantastic, some of it is, well, not, these lions were told in a thousand ways, fawning reviews, profiles in leading magazines, awards, that their voice mattered. Whether or not they always believed it themselves is beside the point. Meanwhile, the tradition of women writers is full of ambitions hidden or thwarted. Emily Dickinson's younger sister was the first to discover her poems. The first collection was published 4 years after the poet's death. Zora Neale Hurston, who once wrote to her patron, Annie Nathan Meyer, oh, if you knew my dreams, my vaulting ambition. I dream such wonderfully complete dreams, so radiant in astral beauty. I have not the power yet to make them come true. They always die. But even as they fade, I have others. Died in poverty, with all of her books out of print. Even Dorothy Parker, who published copiously in her lifetime, was prone to disclaimers that convey the same tentativeness of so many writers who apologize for their work before they share it. She suggested, "Excuse my dust," as her tombstone epitaph, and her obituary in the New York Times featured this statement about her poetry. Quote, "I was following in the exquisite footsteps of Ms. Edna St. Vincent Millay, unhappily in my own horrible sneakers. The first Master of Fine Arts program was founded at the University of Iowa in 1936. Over time, women writers nurtured their ambitions there and at other programs around the country. Today, women writers dominate MFA programs and journalism schools, reveling in a space for their work that once didn't exist. Their ambitions are encouraged and often funded. But there's a difference between being a student writer and a working writer, as is apparent in the uneven welcome offered to our culture's better-known authors. Rather than replicate the established patterns of literary stardom of Vidal and company, we can create a new landscape. We can make new ways to have a public voice through writing, one that writers of all genders might welcome, and that, being mostly outside of it, women writers are in a unique position to create. What might this alternative literary landscape look like? Artificial hierarchies of genre and seriousness would not define it, and it wouldn't glamorize a writer's substance abuse, domestic abuse, as in Mailer's case, and prejudices as evidence of can't-be-contained artistic genius. Instead, writing from any medium, by any writer, would be welcomed and read with a generous mind. Online, in print, or out loud, the words would determine its value. To get there, though, we must consider the assumptions about our own ambitions, our own reading habits, and our own expectations of literary value. We might consider the democratization of online writing not as a devaluation, as Emily Gould suggested in her article, but as an enhancement. Considering that the existing literary canon has excluded or remained ambivalent to an untold number of voices, why wouldn't it be cause for celebration when that trajectory changes? While our alternative literary culture would be misguided to consider the internet its soul-saving grace, we might trust the vibrancy of the internet to push our narrow definitions of who gets to call herself a writer in ways that influence print and spoken word cultures as well. It would be a mistake to simplify the ambitions of writers, particularly female ones, as solely measurable by big-time accolades, fame, or presence in mainstream media. There are those, after all, who pursue writing after a career in another area. There are those who return to writing after decades away from it. Many who write simply want to express themselves or create something beautiful. Being uninitiated into the culture of literary lions and not winning public accolades does not denote a lack of ambition. It is simply writing to a different standard. It may be part of the creation of our alternative to the traditional literary culture. Any writer might feel trepidation about introducing her or himself as a poet, or avoid admitting wanting to win a literary prize. But we must change the game so that when women writers publicly pish-tosh their ambitions as being pipe dreams, they no longer have reason to believe that they are.
My name is Brittany Shute. I am a freelance writer and editor, and some people call me a critic. And occasionally I am known to take care of animals as well. So that, I guess that makes me an animal caretaker. But yeah, I mean, I spend almost all my time writing right now.
So how long have you been reading Bitch?
I've probably been reading Bitch for, I'm going to have to say at least 5 or 6 years. Because I know I read it in college, and I know I'm that old now. So I'd like to say that I picked it up in high school, but I don't know that that's true. And I'm not quite sure where that would have happened, because I grew up in the sticks. Yeah, I think like 5 years.
Why did you pick out the ambition condition to read for Read My Bitch?
This particular article is pretty much the only one that I can think of off the top of my head. And I don't mean that there aren't a lot of great ones in my, you know, personal back catalog. But in the last couple of years that really in particular stood out to me, because it came out right around the time that I went completely freelance as a writer. I mean, I finished grad school and I didn't have a job lined up. And so I moved abroad because my partner isn't from the U.S. And so we decided to live abroad for a little while. And the only thing I can really do here is, you know, sort of hustle odd jobs and write for people back home. So that's what I decided to do. So right around the time that I made that decision, I mean, I think within a few months, the article, I mean, because I moved the same autumn, fall that the magazine came out. And I kept the article by my bedside for months because I would read like a paragraph before I'd go to bed and I would be so overwhelmed. I was like, oh yeah, that's it. That's it, you know? And my partner's asleep. He falls asleep immediately. And so I'm laying there thinking, oh, this is hard. This is going to be really hard. I'm going to have to tell people what I do and it's going to be difficult. And it just really, really, really resonated for me. And I think maybe in particular, what was so interesting was that I didn't read it after I had been doing it for a while. Like, I had been writing for people on and off for a while, but I hadn't been making it, like, my full-time, you know, career. Like, I hadn't said, okay, now I am a writer. And so to read this article, which is all about owning that, I think for me, you know, as I was getting into it, like, I've thought about it a lot since then. There are a couple of my friends who are also writers, and at some point along the way, I also ended up having a conversation with them a little bit because of this article, because they are so reticent to own that they're writers. I mean, one in particular I can think of lately, I've sent her several emails where I've said, you know, have you told anyone lately? Like, very simply, because when people ask her what she does, she just kind of shrugs her shoulders, and they think that she is, I don't know what they think, that she's unemployed, that she is embarrassed about what she does, and she really loves it, you know? I mean, but she can't own it because she doesn't have a traditional job. She doesn't, you know, work a 9-to-5. She doesn't write a lot that has bylines attached. And so when people ask her, what do you write? Have I read anything that you've written? Or would I have seen anything that you've written? Which I think is a really assumptive question anyway, as if you're reading everything that other people are writing. I mean, what? And I'm not great at it either, but I continue to have this conversation with other people. So all of that to say, you know, I've been thinking about this a lot, and I think the piece does a really nice job of dealing with a lot of those issues without blaming women for the state of things. I mean, while acknowledging that we are not very good at owning this, exploring why, you know, culturally this has become the norm for women to just kind of be afraid to talk about what they do when they write or edit or whatever.
Are there other personal experiences you've had that you recognize in the article?
For me, it's very much based on context. So, for instance, with my partner's parents, my in-laws, they're really encouraging and very, very, they validate what I do a lot. So English is not their first language, and it's a little bit trickier for them to read some of the things that I write, but I know that they go out of their way to try. So, for instance, I'm not afraid to tell them, like, oh yeah, I got a new writing gig, and they know I don't make a lot of money doing it, and that is a big issue for me, which we can talk about. But with them, you know, like, I feel really confident because I already know going into the situation that they're going to validate that. Whereas, you know, I was at a dinner with some coworker acquaintance types recently, and someone said, you know, what have you been working on? And I just couldn't speak because I was around people who are 5 or 10 years older than me, who have sort of quote-unquote legitimate careers, you know, very, just seem really stable compared to somebody like me. And I just didn't know what to say, you know, and I got really uncomfortable, and I looked at my partner, which, I mean, what is that about, you know? He's a guy, and I said to him, you know, why don't you tell him? I mean, what am I doing? Like, why would I look to the man in my life and say, well, why don't you defend me now? I mean, it was really, can I swear on the podcast? I mean, it was really, really fucked up. And I left feeling terrible. And I was like, you know, that's just as much my fault as it is everyone else's. Like, I mean, I really fucked that up. I need to own what I do, you know? And I just think it's a struggle for a lot of people.
You wanted to say something about money?
I think that's actually a really big one. I mean, I make total shit as a writer. And if I were single, for instance, I think that the situation would be really different. And I wouldn't be freelance full time because I don't think it would be sustainable. It quite frankly wouldn't have been this last year. I'm finally at the point now where it is, but even then, what is sustainable? Like, I mean, I'm still below what people would consider poverty level. I mean, what is that? And I'm not supposed to say that because, you know, then I'm acknowledging that I'm not, you know, successful by whatever people's standards are. But quite frankly, I really like what I do, and I don't wake up hating myself every day, and I don't have to go to an office that I hate, and that's really where my priority is right now. So what I get hung up on is the fact that, not that I don't make a lot of money, because I don't, that's not really what concerns me, but what does concern me is that I think that other people will know that, or they'll take that as a marker of, like, my success. And if I don't either lie about what I make, or I don't somehow make as much as my male partner, which I'm probably never going to, I think that that's where I get hung up a lot, in not being able to own what I do. Because I think to myself, I know how much money I made today. And if that's my job, that's unfortunate. I know some people do fine, but it seems to be that where I am and the women that I know, it's like, I mean, it's a struggle, you know? It's like, man, like, am I going to pay the bills, or am I going to do X, Y, and Z? I don't know. I mean, because I'm in a position where I can still kind of, you know, I can keep doing this for a while. Like, I almost feel a need to represent some of those people when I say this to you and say, you know, like, I mean, my friends are just barely scraping by.
In the article, Anna Clark mentions how the ambition condition manifests itself in other areas like the National Book Award and in the digital world. And I was wondering if you recognize it playing out elsewhere.
You don't know who you asked, do you? I used to be really involved with internet video, like pre-YouTube. It was all very special and cool. And, I'm not at all anymore, but I used to be involved in a lot of, like, you know, social media tech stuff. I spoke at a couple conferences where I was, like, you know, one of a couple token women that were there. I mean, I saw it. It was one of the reasons I left all of that behind, because I was like, this sucks. And it made more sense to me to focus on writing, which I had done a decent amount of in the past with some decent success. And I said, you know, I don't want to be involved in this tech crap. And also because my partner is, and I don't want to be, I didn't make the decision because of him, but at one point we had worked on something together related to video online, and all of the response we got was directed very specifically at him, even though it had both of our names on it. I mean, people emailed him directly and they were like, great job, never acknowledging that I was a part of it. And I flipped out on him instead of dealing with the larger problem, which was to perhaps contact those people individually. He took it on immediately and said, would email them back and say, these are not emails I should be receiving. This is a collective work, whatever. But I've personally seen it in other arenas multiple times, not just myself, but other friends. And I'm not really surprised. And I think that one of the reasons that I wanted to be a writer was because I really could write about gender issues and talk about what it means to do all of that. I've never written about doing the thing with my partner, but I probably should at some point, because it was really fucked up too, that people just completely ignored my contribution.
So do you think a solution to this problem is more in the hands of the individual woman or writer, or is it the responsibility of institutions like writing programs or publishers or conferences?
Man, that's a really good question. I don't even know, because I've gone to both, not writing specific, but I've gone to both types of tech conferences, for instance, where they were, you know, very gender specific. You know, this is the women's conference. This is, you know, I went to Blogger and Wham, and I did all that stuff. And I also went to the ones where it's, you know, very mixed. And I don't think the guys care when we have our own conference. I don't think they even know. So from that perspective, I would love to think that that space provides something that we need and it builds community. I really don't know, because I like to think that I'm someone who doesn't believe that institutional change is very useful. But that said, I'm not really convinced that, you know, me personally owning that I'm a writer to more people will somehow shift the dynamic, because I do say it to people and I do, you know, I do have that conversation, but I don't know. I will say that while we haven't talked specifically about this article, though I did pass it on to my writer friend recently who won't own that she's a writer. And I said, you need to go read this and then we're going to talk about it, because we got to get you owning this. Like, you may not feel comfortable with it, but we'll get there. But I do think that I tend to pretty much only really correspond with and bump up against other women writers as I do what I do. I mean, some of my editors are men, but I mean, by and large, I tend to, now that I think about it, I tend to work primarily with women. And I approach the writer-to-writer relationship with women differently, because I feel, correctly or otherwise, that we're in it together in a very specific way, because the only other people that I know who are struggling writers are women. And the only guy that I've met recently who also was had a totally different approach about it. I mean, you know, he had already written a novel, but it wasn't published, but he didn't seem to have a hang up about that. Whereas I would never tell someone if I had written a novel, but it wasn't published. Like, I mean, I just couldn't fathom telling people that, because that to me is like, to him, that was a success, you know? And to me, that's like ultimate failure. Mm-hmm. Why would I tell someone that I worked so hard on something that nobody else cared about? What? I just don't feel like I would have the same conversations if I was around male writers, because I don't know what we would say. I think that they're perceived really differently, and, you know, they get to call themselves poets and whatever. I would, you know, never in my life think of saying something like that.
That's interesting, because to me, there are certain parts of the article that really stand out. One of them is Dorothy Parker's proposed epithet, but the other is the example, I'm not really a poet, but, and were there any parts that were sort of like that for you, that were sort of like burrs in your soul in a way?
I do think that, and I've seen this conversation happening a lot again recently on blogs and whatnot, where women are, I guess Anna doesn't deal with this specifically, but there's sort of the idea that men can have this persona that goes along with being a writer, whereas women don't necessarily have that, because we don't have this sort of like hyper-masculine thing about what we do. You know, I'm not some like drinking, womanizing, whatever. And so that doesn't sort of give people this idea of me being the heroic, you know, sort of damaged but brilliant writer. You know, and I don't even really do the like damaging things. I mean, I kind of wish I could, but I get migraines. I can't do that. So, I mean, you know, I can't go out like and like binge drink and like smoke all night and like, you know, have all these like deep thoughts and like make that part of who I am. Like, that doesn't work for someone like me. So that was a big part of it, because, and then sort of going off of that, what I was going to say is that on I've seen some blog posts about it recently, maybe a couple of articles where, you know, women are sort of called upon pretty consistently to mind their personal lives in the same sort of way, but we're supposed to really write about it in this sort of this whole other way, like whether it's embarrassing or whether it's, you know, you have like this failed relationship you're supposed to write about. And to some degree, I have those stories to tell, but you know, sometimes I think maybe I should be writing about my like, you know, deep dark secrets. And then I have to really consider, I'm not Norman Mailer, and it's not 75 years ago, or, you know, whatever. I mean, you know what I mean? Like, it's a time where I can't take it back. Like, I'm going to write it. It's going to be on the internet. My parents are going to read it. I don't even talk to my parents. Like, you know, like, I don't have that freedom. I don't feel that I don't want to give it to myself, whatever, you know. I want to hold myself back, because I don't want my whole life to be online. Like, I already went through that. I was in an internet video. Hello. Like, I'm with that. I guess I think about that when I read the article, because maybe we don't touch on that. It doesn't touch on that quite as specifically, though it does in part of the article that I didn't read. You know, she talks about the piece from the New York Times Magazine a couple years ago that Emily Gould wrote. And it was a lot about, like, publicizing herself on the internet and what that meant and how people treated that as if it wasn't legitimate or worthy, or, and I think there's a lot of truth to that. You know, I mean, at what point can I write about, like, you know, this is my relationship, and people will say, oh, that's valid. Well, it's my relationship, of course it's valid, but I just think it gets treated really differently. So
what do you think of Anna Clark's proposed alternative literary landscape at the end of the article, where she says that writing would be welcomed with an open and generous mind, and only the words would determine its value? What do you think about that, and what effect do you think that would have on feminist writing?
Well, I hadn't really thought about it that way. That would be ideal. But that said, I'm sort of a chronic, you know, cynic. That's tough for me, you know, to say, oh, we will just share ideas and we will have this utopian, you know, genderless, bylineless space where it won't matter. And that sounds great, but I have no conceivable idea of how that would happen. And again, I'm not the person to ask, because, you know, I think the world's going to end. I mean, I'm like the hardcore cynic.
Well, I think those are valid feelings and definitely telling in and of themselves. But I guess, do you have any maybe tips for surviving the world, even cynical tips for women writers out there? I mean, because you're doing it.
Well, you know, I don't want to recommend this, but I'm going to. If you have a name like mine, use your initials. which is, again, really not where I want to go with that. But I wish I had. One of the things that I think can be really helpful is if you write for free, which sounds really counterintuitive. And I know a lot of people think that that's a bad idea. But in my limited experience, occasionally, very occasionally, writing for free can be really good, because it does a couple of things. It makes connections. It shows people that you believe in what you're doing, and it gives you clips. If you haven't written before and you want to move up into writing for certain publications or magazines or whatever, you're going to need something to show them, very simply put. So I think it's okay to write for free. Sometimes when you write for free, people are also more transparent about the editing process. They may have time to guide you a little bit in a way that, editors who are paying you a lot may assume that you already know how to do a lot of things that, you know, they take for granted. Again, this is just my experience, but, you know, I have a small community of writers and editors based on a website that I help edit. And I think that one of the things that has been so helpful for me is to know that even if I don't know those people very well, I can go to some of them for advice. I very recently emailed a writer that works on the site, and I know that we both write for similar publications, and I had what I thought was a really great idea, and I wanted to break into a new publication that I know that she writes for. So I emailed her and just said, you know, their submission guidelines say write on spec and turn in a finished piece. I don't usually do that. Do you think it would be okay to pitch first because you've worked with them before? And not only did she write back and tell me what she would do, which was to pitch first, but she gave me her editor's information, which I thought was really generous and not something that everyone would do. You know, people expect you to find that stuff on your own. That's, you know, part of your job. And then a few days later, I turned around and did something really similar for a writer who contacted me. She had just read my latest thing in Bitch, actually, and said, you know, how could I achieve that someday? And I said, well, you know, if you've never pitched anyone before and you've never written things except for the website that we work on, then here are some general guidelines that you might want to consider when it comes to formulating ideas, writing letters to editors, you know. And then I said, if you have any specific questions, you can feel free to email me anytime. And she can, because people do that for me. There have been so many people that have helped me along the way and helped me put my foot in the door and helped me, you know, whatever. I think that it's also important that people talk about money, because I don't think that very many people do it. And I think that people need to understand that sometimes writers are paying the bills. And I'm not saying that you should write inflammatory crap. And I know that a lot of people, you know, pay the bills writing fluffy stuff. And quite frankly, sometimes a gig is a gig. And I think that if people want to hold up a certain writer and say, oh, she's so prolific, she's, you know, she's so idealistic, that's great. But she might also be broke. And I think it's important to recognize that, you know, sometimes you just need work. On the flip side, there are people who have made their names writing fluffy stuff. And, you know, that's always really frustrating to someone like me, because I see that and think, you know, I'd probably kill for her for the paychecks that she brings in. But, you know, that is what it is. I think that there's also, this is unrelated, but I think that one of the reasons that it's so hard to own being a writer for some women is because the job is so much more public than some other positions can be. So, you know, I, for instance, have done my share of clerical work and, you know, administrative stuff over the years. And that, to me, at least, never felt like it, you know, had a real representation of who I was. It didn't, you know, my job didn't really reflect my identity or my goals in life or my ideals or, you know, any of that stuff. I mean, and you can pick any job, you know, that you don't feel is representative. I'm not hating on clerical work. I'm just saying, when you're a writer, again, in my experience, because I do primarily do stuff that has bylines attached, I think it changes the dynamic a lot, because then people do think that they have a sense of who you are or what your ideals are or what, you know, what you stand for, what your politics are. And the job is really public in a way that many jobs are not. Even if you were like a public servant, you know, like maybe, you know, you work in the government, it's still, I think, just a really different experience. And that said, so I used to be really offended when people didn't read what I wrote, you know, because I thought that they were somehow turning their backs on, like, my identity, you know. But I have a good friend who's a pharmacist, for instance, and I don't call and ask him what prescriptions he filled today. Do you know? Like, I don't – it's a totally different thing. So I had to change my expectations of what it meant to have a job that was sort of public and one that is, you know, to some degree, you know, misunderstood for that reason, because people just don't – people know that they read. I guess a lot of people don't read, and that's sort of a stressful part of being a writer, because you realize that a lot of people don't read very much. But I just had to change how I felt about it. I had to assume that no one was reading, and that was okay. And, you know, then I'm always really pleasantly surprised when they do. You know, my best friend called me the other day and said, hey, I read this recent thing that you wrote, and I showed it to my boyfriend, and it was really nice. And I was like, well, thank you. You know, I mean, and then I felt really good about it. You know, I sort of had a negative attitude for a positive life, which is a phrase I'm directly borrowing from her even. I mean, you know, you just don't expect very much. And then you know, you're really happy when people come through.
You can read The Ambition Condition by Anna Clark by browsing at bitchmedia.org/articles or in issue 41 of Bitch Magazine. You can also read Brittany Schuette's guest blog, The Biotic Woman, at bitchmedia.org/profile/b. An article by Emily Gould on confessional writing by women will be appearing in the fall issue of Bitch Magazine. Subscribe online at bitchmedia.org/subscribe. If you're a Bitch Magazine reader and you'd like to be on Read My Bitch, contact me, Sherston Johnson, at online@b-word.org and tell me who you are, what you'd like to read and why, and if you have access or experience with digital recording. Listen to more Bitch podcasts at bitchmedia.org/audio or search for us on iTunes. Thanks again for listening.